This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
That's always sort of been the Animal Collective philosophy, you know, just keep changing and keep rolling with the changes. It seems like even situations that have seemed like they were going to be a disaster or bad, sometimes you just have to turn them into something good, grow from it and move on. And nothing lasts, right? Like nothing is supposed to. You can't hold on to anything, really.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
And this is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory, but we drew the map.
Davey, tell us the story of Invisible Darlings.
This is the
single off your new Avatar.
Mm-hmm. It's the kind of the focus track for putting out the record. And I had two other singles before. This one, it's like kind of the Invisible Darlings is kind of like the upbeat song on the record, mostly written on piano and centered around like a very fast kind of moving piano line that kind of goes through the whole song. It's got a lot of cool.
Has the feel of like a harpsichord almost.
I can see that. I do like harpsichords. I'm a big harpsichord fan. Listen to a lot of kind of early music, kind of like Baroque harpsichord music, actually.
Is that where your inspiration comes from then, the early music?
I have been listening to it a lot more in the last few years. Yeah, I would say it's influenced a lot of the more recent Animal Collective stuff. And Animal Collective, we have another record that we're just finishing up that hopefully we'll be able to put out sometime. that I feel like
we know the feeling.
Yeah. That I feel like is influenced a lot by some early music, early harmony stuff, kind of harmony singing and Gregorian style kind of early harmony.
I was more interested in the lady in the Steak and Shake.
Oh, right.
Lovely story.
Yeah. I just met this woman, and I'm a pretty shy person when it comes to just being kind of out in the world talking, except for some reason when I'm on trails, I'm very talkative when I'm like out camping, maybe because there's usually no one else around. So like when you see somebody, you're like, oh, hi, how are you? Like, talk to me.
I feel that's like a sort of characteristic of a lot of Americans, because, back in the days where they were humping over top of mountains to try and get to, the West Coast and that, the pioneer days, you had to be friends with people, because if you weren't, they might be eating you that night or something, you know, so it's...
But you might not survive one way or another, yeah.
Yeah, you might not survive. So I think that's a trait of a lot of Americans, which is, yeah, admirable.
Yeah, so I encountered this woman working at a Steak and Shake, and I went in there with my girlfriend to get some milkshakes, and this woman just started, you know, talking. Well, I thought at first was just sort of kind of maybe like babbling a little to me, maybe bored, but also kind of referencing religious stuff that I just, you know, thought was very out there. It was sort of like, you know, I told her my name was Dave, and she's like, well, we had Daniel in here the other week, and, you know, I asked him how the lion's den was. No, you know, I was just kind of like,
Oh, really? Wow.
And, you know, my girlfriend went to the bathroom, and I was just, you know, kind of like mulling around, talking to her, and then she went and got her our milkshakes and came back with them, and she was like, I stuck my finger in both of them and tasted it and make sure it was all right. And I was like, all right, you know, a good joke, you know, it got me laughing, made me feel good. I'd been in kind of a crummy mood, just driving a while, traffic and all that. And yeah, it was, and I just, I don't know, was kind of grateful when I got back to the car for, to have that, you know, experience and just have that interaction and put me in a better mood. So it's that, that's the kind of thing that the song's about, really, just, you know.
That's a lovely story. I like the thing I'm just going to quote. Is you say, it's healthy to open your eyes and see that there are good things happening around us all the time, you know.
Yeah.
But we just have to be open to them, really. I love that.
Yeah. That's something that we talk a lot about. My wife is the person who can see all those things in the world. She's like, you know, I'm sort of, you know, perhaps a little darker and doomier, you know, and she's full of light and love, and she helps, you know, helps me, you know, see that side of life more, you know. So, you're right. It's always there. It's always there. You have to be able to perceive it.
I live in Berlin, you know. that's kind of a difficult place at times to run into the lighter side of life and see.
I'm in LA as well.
Yeah, well, yes. Even though it's sunny outside, it's
yeah. I don't. What are they doing? I suppose in LA, they can't, you go roll your windows and make sure your car's locked. You know, because here too, you know, because if you do something wrong in a traffic maneuver, the Berliner will tell you exactly. You know. Make it a point of getting out the car and telling you what you just did wrong.
Oh, yeah. Do you drive around? Do you drive around Berlin?
No, I stick now to like a cargo bike, it's like an e-bike with like two children in the front. The children are a great foil because they like children here, so that's yeah. Okay. But actually, my horns don't come out as often as they used to do when I was driving, so I'm kind of mellowing as a driver as well.
We were talking to somebody else the other day about that, about driving, and they live here in LA as well, and we, you know. We're both from Europe, and we're sort of saying, you know, when we first start driving around here and people cut you off, you know, you get a bit upset at it, and maybe you get a bit mad at them. And then suddenly there comes that point where you realize, they probably have a gun in the car. So perhaps, you know, just wave nicely and smile and drive on and forget it, you know, because, you don't know what's going to happen.
I feel so terrible when people get angry at me on the road for some reason. It's really crushing. I'm just kind of like, it's the end. It's like ruins my day completely. I just like can't handle it.
I think my saving grace. I've lived in Berlin quite almost over a decade now, and my German hasn't improved, which I think has been a kind of saving grace, really, that I don't hear. I hear them, but I have no idea what they're saying, and it could be, you know, hey, you're a really nice, you're a really great driver. Yeah. Only I'm sure that's not what's going on, because I can tell. I can read the body language, but the body language isn't as insulting somehow, you know.
Right.
You can misinterpret that. So, yeah, I kind of live in a sort of, my own little world quite often when I'm out and about, protected from the local.
Yeah.
banter.
Yeah, I find my ongoing hearing loss is good for protecting me from all of that as well. You know, I can walk around like Mr. Magoo and not hear anything. You know, it's like, did you hear that? No, it didn't.
Is this the downsides to years of drumming and no ear protection? Yeah, okay, yeah.
And you, did you not wear your plugs much, or neither of you earplugs fans, or did you?
Back then, there were no in-ear monitors, there were nothing like that. If I go to a gig now, yeah, I take earplugs and stuff and that, but I think some of it's irretrievable, you know.
I think I told you, didn't I, I think it was the Juju tour, and we decided that we'd try and get all of the, like, amps and wedges monitors off out, clear the stage. So we were playing theater venues, so every venue we had quite a big crew that would build a stage on top of the existing stage that was tall enough away from the stage to swallow floor cans, you know, like, right, those big bulky lights that were in use at those times, and the wedges with perspex and grills that covered the things. We did this every night in different theatres. It's a massive amount of work. And I had these two Ampeg SVTs lying side down behind the riser at the back of the stage, and just a row of amps so I could hear everybody's backline. Mm-hmm. And strapped to my head with gaffer tape, whereas like these lightweight Sennheiser bright yellow spongy headphones, and we went through like a pair each night. I don't know what that was doing to my young ears, but and it didn't look kind of that good, you know, having headphones on. It looked like you were a bit kind of too studious, but it was actually quite...
Yeah, it's a tough one to pull off, right? Sometimes.
Yeah, it was in a way. It was kind of quite an innovation, because they did cut you off enough to, if the jack came out, or if the guy who was like, you know, my tech hadn't plugged them in, it was down yeah, below the riser, yeah, somewhere, and sometimes, yeah, he fell asleep, you know. It's very unbanshee like to fall asleep during you know.
Yeah, no sleep really till Hammersmith, which is a normal one.
That was, yeah, the t-shirt for that tour, right, and many of them, yeah. What was it? Sleep luxury. No luxury until Bangkok, because that's where we were always apparently heading, but we never got there. David, tell us about the Sevens and Sevens. I like that your album's coming out on, well, it's out on the 17th.
Yeah, out on the 17th, out in 2023, which is also seven altogether. I wanted the number seven to be, once there were seven songs on the record, it just kind of felt, it made sense to me to have the number seven be alive in you know, the tie.
I like you even more now. I realize you're a numerologist like me. I like that.
I do like numbers. They're interesting how it works. The good Cure song three. I like that Cure song. Interesting, very interesting Cure song.
Yes, and that was definitely connected to that. Yeah, thank you.
A lot of crazy piano, and is that influenced by like kind of modern composition, sort of avant-garde kind of stuff, would you say? Or?
Yeah, I'm gonna say yes. I mean, we were probably like 22 when we did that, so we were aware of stuff, you know, but especially for that album, we decided at one point, there's some recordings of us all playing each other's instruments, because we decided, hey, we're going to do some tracks, but, you know, I'm going to play guitar, put Robert on the drums, you know, and then, you know, just swap everything around a bit. And we recorded some stuff like that. So that was like the experimental part of it. And we wanted to come across with that. So yeah, there's always been that in it, but I think also in the end we love a good melody and a good, yeah, rhythm, you know, so that's that tends to poke its ugly head up every so often, you know, above all the experimentation.
You've just spun me off back to my youth and Hawkwind, I'm afraid.
Yes.
And it was a song called 7x7.
Oh yeah.
And I can quote you a couple of lines from it. It says, seven signs road on seven stars, seven ways to find the long lost bards. I love it. And then the last two lines are wonderful. No more to cry, O mortal soul. The astral path is now your fortuitous role.
Oh dear.
I have to check that one out. I don't know if I know that.
Oh, it's David Brock. Yeah. God, when was that released?
73, I'd say.
Yeah, somewhere around there. 73. That's a good 71, actually.
Okay, even earlier. Wow. That was good. Search of Space was a brilliant album. Yeah, I love that. Was that the one that had the gatefold sleeve that turned into a shield?
They all did.
Well, there was one that you folded out and you could put your arm through the thing, take the record out, put your arm in. It was like this magical shield you could walk around with, you know, like, can you imagine any record company wanting to pay for that now?
Yeah, I think that was the next album. This In Search of Space were, how many Hawkwind albums were there? And it says,
I don't know.
Quite a bit. Well, they had a few lineup changes as well.
35 right? studio There's... albums?
Oh, my gosh. Didn't In Search of Space come with a booklet as well that said things about, like, you know, mysterious facts, like, you know, a little insect that sat on a plant for 35 years waiting to leap off and you know, commit its destiny or something. I remember that.
In Search of Space is definitely the big prog one, right? That's definitely one of the more popular rock ones.
That certainly had a lot of... Yeah.
So I think
I'm going to have to dig that one out, I'm afraid.
That points to our sort of, like, you know, where we were, the juxtaposition of the bloody hippies and the damn punks, you know. It's sort of like, that's where we surfaced, somewhere in between those things. So you get, you know, the hooks of both sides get put in you, you know. So
who was the guiding? I was talking to some guys in the college gig I do, and they were talking about Lemmy.
Yes.
And Lemmy just kind of came from the Hawkwind. Yeah. Through into Motorhead, which embraced anything that came alongside of Motorhead. So punk came along and post-punk. Lemmy was always at the bar.
Yeah.
Still putting money into the slot machine, you know.
Slot machine and eating
them. Meanwhile, you know, me and Pete Shelley from the Buzzcocks, and then like you know, the Clash would wander through. And there's Lemmy just putting more with a Jack and Coke. And he was sort of like be the sort of granddaddy somehow, you know.
Yeah.
Going, it's all right. Yeah. Just carry on doing what you're doing. You'll be all right.
My favorite memory of him was we played 1979. We played the Reading Festival, and you know it was all full of metalheads who didn't really like us much. You know, he came and sat in our little backstage trailer, and told us, "You're all right, lads. Everything's going to be okay." And pulled out this big bottle of vodka and gave it to us, I remember. So he was always a nice guy in my mind, you know. Always.
Did you like playing festivals much?
It depends. I mean, one festival I really liked that we did, 1985 in Athens in Greece, and there was like 100,000 people in this old Olympic stadium, and that was a really good night. I loved that one. I can still remember it. But there was a riot as well, which wasn't so great, you know. But,
well, you had to have a riot, didn't you? Greece, Italy, it's always a riot.
Always a riot, yeah.
And the police would come on stage and try and, like, you know, stop the audience, tear gas.
Well, I remember seeing policemen being carted out at the back of the backstage area in Athens, you know, having been, you know, knocked out by flying debris or things, you know. It was pretty scary. Yeah. And the water cannons came out and stuff. I sound like the old guy talking about the Second World War now, don't I?
No, the Banshees never really got the festival spirit. We liked it dark in the theatre.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, our own gig. I think the Lollapalooza was perhaps the only experience of that nature. It was so unique and just too much, really. It was too much, I think, than anybody could handle. The idea, because it traveled around the States for a couple of years, I think, and then it kind of just said, you know what, we'll just stay in Chicago. let everybody come to us. But it was quite unique. And the last gig we played as Susie and the Banshees was a beach festival. Oh, God, it was in Belgium, I think. And it was bright, brilliant sunlight. And we just thought, this is no way to end.
Yeah. But, you know, conversely, that probably made it better to feel like it's ending, because it's like, if it's going to be like this, we better bloody stop now.
Right. Slit my wrists now and let me be gone. And then it becomes the beginning of the next chapter, really. I think that's what's always been amazing, is just, you know, Lol and I finding each other after all these years. None of this would have happened without all the stuff that went before it, and all the stuff that went before it is amazing to think back on. But somehow you've got to keep changing. You've got to be, or just maybe open to change. Do you find that with what you're doing?
Oh yeah, that's always sort of been the Animal Collective philosophy. You know, just keep changing and keep rolling with the changes. It seems like even situations that have seemed like they were going to be a disaster or bad, sometimes you just have to turn them into something good, grow from it and move on. And nothing lasts, right? Like nothing is supposed to. It's you can't hold on to anything, really. So it's best to...
No.
No, there's nothing to hold on to. There really isn't anything to hold on to, you know? And I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? You know, like lack of control is our dilemma, you know, because... Hey, you can't control any of this. And so you just have to, it's like surfing. You have to be on top of the wave and ride with it until you fall off, you know? And I've fallen off a few times.
It's also the blessing and curse of making great records, you know, and leaving these kind of landmarks in time, you know what I mean? It's because those records people hold on to, you know, and it becomes a different kind of perspective and a point of view, you know, because it's, you know, you get locked into that time of when you put out that old record or whatever, and it's maybe sometimes harder for other people to move on from that than it is for me. Or
what do you think will be happening for you next? Are you gonna go out live?
Yeah, I'm gonna go do a short North American tour to start, and we'll see where it goes from that. Just, you know, get into it in the spring, and then yeah, see where it goes from there.
Any big changes for you? Yeah, is it as the time off giving you time to think or rethink, or is it business as usual, or is it something?
It's a little bit of everything. I mean, I think this year feels like a sort of a good change, move into new territory, kind of a frame of mind, and so I'm seeing where it goes. I'm open to it, you know. We got done you know, a lot of Animal Collective touring last year, so this year's gonna be different than that. Yeah, just take it every year differently, you know. I was curious if you guys were open to talking about it just a little. Like, I was just curious how psychedelics factored into your creative day.
Psychedelics. What could it mean?
Psychedelic drugs.
Oh,
sorry.
Oh,
psychedelic,
okay.
As they are called. When I was in high school, I got into making music because of, you know, the classic 60s psychedelic, and Syd Barrett was, you know, a big fan. But then I also thought a lot of records of y'all's era, you know, Pornography,
yeah,
you know, were psychedelic records to me, but they don't really jump out to you as psychedelic records. And they're not, you know, that scene isn't really sort of presented as a psychedelic scene. And maybe it is, but to me, like in high school, that was great psychedelic music, what y'all did. And so I'm just curious how that played into it.
I think that you correctly categorized Pornography, yes. Correctly. Because there was a lot of stuff going on, but I would say it was probably the darker side of psychedelia, you know, which end up turning out the record that we turned out. But it took a little while. Some of the days in the studio were challenging, but it's still my favorite record we ever made as The Cure, you know. But it was everything all out, and yeah, you know, especially, yeah, Robert has always had an interest in those things, and you know, they were always there.
What year was that?
81, 82, something like that, I think.
Well, yeah. I've just pulled up because I know that A Kiss in the Dream House is,
yeah, that would be another one, I'd say, or Kaleidoscope World.
It's been repackaged redone on vinyl, some kind of collector's thing. It's I just saw it up on Susie's site. And it says here, what Julian Marcelik of The Quietus said proved to be one of the great British psychedelic bands we were. But yeah, there was some kind of pretty trippy stuff going on around Camden Town in those months, June to August 1982. I can see it at the corner of my eye.
Yes.
I'm sort of writing a little memoir at the moment, and that's one area I would like to venture back into. Just trying to piece it all together. There was a lot of experimentation going on, which can be great. It just about worked. You know, we would go up to Camden and turn into the studio, having been to the Greek restaurant where we drank Retsino because nobody else would drink the stuff. And but we'd really would just be playing around with loops and tapes and slowing the kit down as it was going to tape. Without telling me, you know.
Yeah.
I still have the cassette where everybody's kind of like, you know, that kind of button when it goes down in the steam, they're going like, all you can hear in the background is like, you know, are you going to tell him yet? No. And I'm going, listen, guys, it's really not funny. It doesn't sound very funny. I mean, it just sounds a bit weird. And I'm just like losing it rapidly in this little booth of the drum kit. But, a lot of kind of really interesting stuff came out of it, and lyric-wise, very rare. There's a lot of reference going on.
I think also for The Cure that our roots were, you know, when people asked me to describe what The Cure were, I'd say we were a psychedelic punk band, because that's the truth. You know, the records that we listened to earlier on was, you know, it was Trautmask Replica. You know, like we had that, and if you listen to that when you're like 12, 13, which we did, you know, at first, you can't listen to it. You think, oh my God, what's going on here? I can't understand it. And then suddenly you get the key into it. It's very good. I made my son listen to that actually when he was about 12, and he thanks me for it now, you know. But yeah, that's where we came from. We came from the psychedelic stuff and you know, the other stuff that goes with that, of course, has to come in, you know. But then all of a sudden, there was punk. So, you know, that's it. It's two sides of different coins, maybe. But that was the impetus for us doing what we did.
Mm-hmm. Susie was a big fan of Jim Morrison. I can see that the Doors' first album, I think, Kiss in the Dream House, which was like inspired by Gustav Klimt, his artwork. But there's like a kind of a little homage to the kind of the band in nestling in Jim's hair, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
There's a little like little, okay, you can get it if you know what's going on. And there's lots of tricks that, you know, we'd somehow stumbled across, like Jim Morrison would constantly whisper the words in the background of the spot, you know?
Yeah. Bob does that all the time. Yeah. He'd sit there and it was funny when I did a tour with them back in 2011. We did like the first three albums, and you know, for the first time, because The Cure never used tracks ever, right? You know, everything was played from the stage, you know, apart from the reel to reel for the drum machine. But we had some noises in Pornography. But you know, now everybody uses some kind of track, so we had tracks. But we take things off the multi-track. And it'd be like, you know, Bob's backwards whispering echoes and things, you know. So it's kind of funny, you know, like listening to them in you know, soloed, you know.
Right.
Really? What were you on when you said all that stuff? It's like 4 o'clock in the morning and you're mumbling into the mic, you know.
we used to have the kind of the LSD listening quiz. You know, it was kind of what does the music stand up to a trip? And I remember sitting with Billy Chainsaw one night, and we'd just like the Human League Stare had just come out, and we were going like, can't hear any music. There's nothing going on here. It was weird. And then Billy, kind of a rainbow came out of his mouth. You know, it's kind of weird. Can't really piece together any kind of sense out of, you know, the stuff you try to explain about.
Right, but, yeah, hard to describe.
It's kind of weird because it went in several different phases, you know, the kind of the availability of hallucinogenics and stuff like that. Our producer, who we shared with The Cure as well, Mike Hedges, who also did The Associates first bunch of albums, he was always on the hunt for rare peyote and stuff, you know.
I got some peyote. There's only a little bit of it, so I can't share.
David, it's lovely to meet you. That's really nice.
Yes, lovely to meet you.
Yeah, lovely to meet you guys. Great talking to you.
Curious Creatures is created and presented by Lol Tolhurst and Butchie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Digital marketing, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cura Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2023.